Welcome to Everything Co-op, bringing you information on how cooperatives can help improve your quality of life. This show is being sponsored by the National Co-op Bank, NCB. The NCB is dedicated to strengthening communities nationwide for the delivery of banking and financial services for the nation's cooperatives, their members, and other socially responsible organizations. On the power of community ownership, visit ncb.coop. That's ncb.coop. Now stay tuned for your host, Vernon Oakes.
Good morning, everybody. This beautiful, beautiful Thursday morning in Washington, D.C. The sun's up. It's warm. We're going to talk to Renee Hatcher today. Renee, this is Women's History Month, and this month the theme is to talk to women that advocate for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Vernon. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm really excited to be here with you for Women's History Month and looking forward to this conversation.
I am also. Okay. So, Renee, what kind of work do you do?
So, my work primarily is working with cooperatives. I am a professor at UIC Law School based here in Chicago, where I teach a number of business law courses as well as occasionally critical race feminism. But most of my time at the law school is spent directing a clinic called the Community Enterprise and Solidarity Economy Clinic. And so in that role, what I do is I get to work directly with mostly worker cooperatives, but also housing cooperatives and other type of cooperative businesses and community-based organizations, providing legal support to those organizations to help them get started or sometimes help them navigate different types of issues in developing their business. So that can be things like structuring a relationship through a contract with some of their vendors or partners. That can look like counseling them on the different regulations that they might need to be aware of to be successful in their cooperative business. So I do a lot of that work through the clinic. And in addition to that, we do quite a bit of advocacy around cooperative development here in Chicago. And so really trying to find ways to remove obstacles and barriers to the for the cooperative ecosystem based here in Chicago and also the greater Illinois area. But then also trying to help get resources and build out a really flourishing ecosystem so folks can kind of build these institutions that serve them and that are actually helping folks have more self-determinations in their communities and neighborhoods in Chicago.
Institutions that serve them. What kind of institutions are those?
So, as you know, and I think so, I appreciate your show so much and really digging into the different types of cooperative work that folks are doing. But cooperatives are owned and controlled by their members. And so sometimes, in terms of the worker cooperative work that we're doing, often what we might see is worker owners coming together to start a worker cooperative because of the types of exploitation that they face in the mainstream economy. So now, instead of being exploited, sometimes suffering wage theft in the mainstream economy, they are creating businesses that they own and control where they can set their working conditions, where they can have a say in all of the major decisions about worker benefits and rights. So that's one way in which we see this. We also have been working with a number of folks who are thinking about really the crisis around housing right now in every city across the U.S. So folks are coming together to start either intentional communities or housing cooperatives and trying to create more permanently affordable housing and being able to do that in community with a collective of folks has certainly been something, a growing trend that we're seeing here. And then even going beyond that, you know, neighborhoods or residents coming together to start community land trusts. So this is kind of a moment, at least for Chicago, in that we're seeing a lot of activity around folks starting new community land trusts, some of which are aimed also at bringing more housing online that's permanently affordable. But others that are really thinking about how do we collectively steward vacant land in our neighborhood? How do we make choices together as a community around what we want to see in terms of development? So there's a number of different types of both community land trust projects that are developing and coming online here in Chicago, as well as folks thinking about resident involvement in commercial development more broadly. And so we're also seeing a number of projects where folks are thinking through the different ways in which regular day residents can have ownership and also some type of participation in commercial corridors and the development of commercial corridors, many of which are based on the south and west sides and have been disinvested from, neglected certainly by city government for a very long time.
Wow. Renee, did you just wake up one morning and say, I'm going to do this? How did you get into this work? Particularly, going to law school is very expensive and takes a lot of time. A lot of effort, a lot of energy, and most people want to come out and get attached to a large law firm where they can make big money. I don't think teaching you make big money, and being a director of the Community Enterprise and Solidarity Economy Law Clinic at the University of Illinois Chicago, I don't think that would be big money. So what caused you to go down this route in your career?
Yeah, no, thanks for that question, Bernie. You're absolutely right in that law school is very expensive. I have had loans to prove it for a very long time. And more recently, one of the small personal successes, I recently got my loans forgiven as a part of, it was a big deal, I will say.
I know it's a big deal. And I guess Biden and the Democrats on this one have really hit a home run for blacks and Latino indigenous people, poorer folk, that they don't have this loans that strap them. And I'm sorry here, I'll go back to your question in a minute, but I did property management, as you know, for 20 years in D.C. And I would see people after people after people. Some graduated, some had doctorates, some didn't graduate, but had these huge debt, debt. And too often that messed up their credit score. Student loans and doctors messed up credit scores.
So absolutely. It speaks to, I mean, and one of the reasons that I mention it too is just like to raise the way in which our economy is structured and more or less like who gets support and who carries the burden, right, of some of the ways in which we've structured this economy. And students are primarily, I would say, in terms of thinking about both the rate of interest on student loans and also just the increasing cost of receiving, you know, a 4-year degree or certainly like a graduate degree. It hamstrings our economy in different ways and places the burdens on those who are primarily the working class. And so I mention it for that reason as well. And that also, I think, you know, the recent executive orders and changes that the Biden administration has made around student loans shows the ways in which these are choices that we can make and to actually allow things to function differently. So I think it speaks to a lot of what we're talking about also just in terms of cooperatives being a different way in which folks can structure institutions that benefit the working class, that benefit, that can really start to help us build microeconomies that can have an impact on our macroeconomy. But part of that also is thinking about the way in which regulations structure this economy and the law structures this economy. And so that's a lot of what my research and my work is really about. But going back to your question, how did I get into this work? So, you know, I certainly am someone who comes from a long tradition of really thinking about Black liberation and the Black freedom movement. And so part of my experience, both in my lineage and I want to give a lot of credit to my parents as well, who were both active in the civil rights movement. My father was very active in the civil rights movement. You know, he was someone who went to law school to think about how to use his law degree to really change the quality of life of Black people in this country. And so he was a part of Freedom Summer. He went down to Mississippi, both in 64 and then again in 65 as a law student, and working with SNCC and in thinking about the different lawsuits that were being brought in the South around Jim Crow and racial discrimination, but then also went on to really think about, like, how do we actually change the rules of the road in government? And mm-hmm. so my father ran for office in Gary, Indiana, at a time where, you know, there weren't any black mayors across the country. He was the first elected black mayor of a major U.S. city. And a lot of that was thinking about the ways in which black folks in particular had been left out of the benefits of government services, both at a local level and a federal level. And so thinking that, you know, electoral strategies were an important part, right, of the larger progress for the black freedom movement at the time. And so when he got elected in 1967 as the mayor of Gary, a lot of his administration initiatives was really at improving the quality of lives and also allowing access for black folks in Gary, who at the time were almost the majority in the city at that point. And so his administration really focused on trying to bring new affordable housing online, but also allowing for the first time for blacks to be hired by City Hall, doing away with our both restrictive covenants and the ways in which, like, black folks in Gary had been left out of certain neighborhoods or moving to certain neighborhoods, even if they could afford it. And so my experience, you know, several years later, growing up in Gary, I was trying to make sense of the progression of the city and also just, you know, my experience as a teenager who was trying to figure out how, you know, post-industrialization and Gary, you know, by and large is more than 80% black, certainly since the 60s and 70s, had been disinvested from, like, on a wide scale. And a lot of that went way beyond what was happening in the cities or choices that could be made in the city. It was, you know, it was the way in which state government intervened at times to actually try to undermine, I think, the city itself, or to try to exploit certain assets that the city had in terms of access to the lakefront. We have a lot of rail infrastructure that comes through the city. And so part of what I was doing was trying to really think through, okay, how do you use the tools of the law to really try to address these problems that almost all black and brown cities and neighborhoods are experiencing now? And so through a number of experiences, I started my legal career at the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, doing a range of things, but primarily working in their community development law program. I started to see the limitations of the current tools that we had. And so through a number of years of practice and reflection on that practice, really kind of settled my practice into cooperative development and trying to think through how we can use the law or advocacy related to policy changes to improve the cooperative ecosystem, to improve the cooperative economy, specifically in black and brown neighborhoods. And so, you know, I say all that to say that I think that my progression into this work was really started long before I got into any of this work, but also traces back to the fact that black folks in this country have always built institutions, right, to try to improve both our current situation, but also to resist to resist injustice, to resist discrimination, to resist the both very tangible and intangible ways that black folks are oppressed in this country, often through the mechanisms of the law and the ways in which it gets legitimized. And so I say all that to say that, you know, I feel very fortunate to this work, but also that this is nothing new. And I'm always very aware of that in tracing even, you know, what this current moment might be.
So your father's the mayor of Gary. You're a teenager and trying to figure out all of this stuff and how the city works or doesn't work for black folk. And you end up in co-ops. So how did you end up in co-ops, mm-hmm. in a cooperative ecosystem?
Yep.
And what does co-op businesses bring to blacks and browns and indigenous folk?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, no, thanks for that. You know, and kind of going back to fill in a little bit more of the story. So after a number of years of working at the Lawyers Committee, one of the things that became really clear to me was that the way that the status quo works around economic development, you know, there's not just a lot of neglect, but there's displacement, there's a range of economic harms that tend to happen to communities of color around economic development in particular. And so part of what activated me around co-ops was reading not just Collective Courage when Jessica Gordon Imhart published it, I think in 2014, but a number of her articles about urban cooperative development certainly were touch points for me. But then when Collective Courage was published, one of the things that really resonated with me and struck a chord with me in reading Jessica's book was her research and her writing about cooperative development in Gary, Indiana. And so learning about Jacob Reddicks, who was a vice principal at our historically black high school when public education was still segregated in Gary, and the way in which he activated, and not him in particular, right? There were a lot of times like we trace things back to certain people, but we don't necessarily fully see the group of folks and the critical mass of people who are working, you know, in collaboration with them to kind of bring these projects or cooperatives about. But in Gary, in the wake of the Great Depression, there was an effort to start a buying club. And that buying club ultimately turned into two cooperative grocery stores in Gary, the Cooperative Consumer Trading Company. And ultimately, those two cooperative grocery stores, you know, had hundreds of memberships, and then also had a women's guild, ultimately opened a cooperative gas station in Gary. They opened a candy store and ice cream shop that in part was controlled and managed by like their youth guild in the cooperative. But more than that, what was most interesting about reading about some of that work was that they were collectively coming together to really put together a larger strategy for the city of Gary. Yeah. And specifically black folks in the city, you know, and again, it was out of both necessity, but it was also coming from a place of community and collaboration and cooperation. And, you know, at that time, a number of black families in Gary were, you know, may have had a family member or head of household who's working in the steel mill. Well, in the Great Depression, the black workers at the steel mill were the first ones fired, you know, and so this became in large part really popular in part because of what we know as the systemic discrimination and oppression of like black folks. And I think that, you know, that fact, that spirit still rings true today. And certainly in some of my work and working with you know, majority black-owned co-ops or Latinx-owned co-ops or immigrant-owned co-ops, it's in part out of both community and necessity that folks are coming together and really creating both the businesses that they want to see, but also the internal conditions that are, you know, really important for folks to be able to thrive within the capitalist system. And so for all of those reasons, I mean, I think really one of the ways in which everything kind of clicked for me around cooperative development was reading about my own local history and the work that had come before. And then also thinking about how all of those things are still true today and trying to apply some of the same strategies.
Do you know what happened to those co-ops, those two?
I do. So, you know, I like to say, and you know, that's one thing that we're also trying to elevate, is that just because co-ops don't continue in perpetuity doesn't mean that they're not successful. But a lot of what happened, Jacob Reddicks himself, who again was kind of well positioned to be a large part of like the startup. He was not only, you know, bringing folks together around this buying club, but initially it started as a study group. And before it was a study group, he was actually doing activities inside Roosevelt High School with high school kids around cooperative development, around entrepreneurial like development. And so he then goes on to move away to take a different position. And beyond that, it's a little bit difficult to understand exactly when the cooperative grocery store, you know, dissolved. But one of the things that I think was so important about Jessica putting in their book is like that often we are, you know, we have these histories that new generations are never exposed to. And so I think, and the same thing goes for DC, right? DC has a very rich history in cooperative development, even in the city supporting cooperative development, that probably not a lot of folks know unless like we unearth these histories and actually bring them into recent memory and make sure that we tell these stories. But, you know, similar to other cooperative movements around that time, there was a high increase of cooperative development in the wake of the Great Depression, as we can imagine, like in this moment of crisis, right? Folks come together and like what we have in these moments of crisis is each other, right? And our collective cooperation. And then at some point again, like it dissipates in different ways. And so I don't have the full story in terms of what exactly happened or when the moment was that CCTC disbanded, but at the same time, like we kind of can tell, like over and looking through history for touch points, that often there are similar trends. And so that's actually one of the things that we're trying to continue to think about is like, how do we ensure that even as maybe cooperatives emerge and live out their life cycle in whatever way that looks like, how do we learn the lessons of those cooperatives? How do we also see them, you know, as important infrastructure, even if they no longer exist, but also how do we create an ecosystem that allows for that kind of transference of knowledge and the continuing of cooperative development, even if one particular cooperative is no longer operating?
So I'm interested in that last question of what happened, because I have it that co-ops are phenomenal in helping people that don't have political power or economic power to get it. And too often they're not around anymore. And the question is why. And so in reading Dr. Nimhard's book and doing some of my own little research, it looks like that some whites don't like to see blacks improving or getting anything. So they'll come in and try to take or steal or whatever. Tulsa is a great example. Or they get people to come in. You may pay somebody to come in and get in a co-op to create havoc. And the main thing is that too often blacks and browns, when they start getting some sense of power, some sense of economic worth, that there's a white power that comes in, wants to take it or disrupt it or close it down or take it over, take over the land, take over the building, take over the customers, whatever. And that's too often. Now, sometimes it may be there's some stuff that happens internally, because you still get people, some people, maybe even most in a co-op, are there to help each other, the solidarity economy, working together solidly to support each other. But you can get some in there that get hooked on greed, get hooked on what's for me and only for me, or me and my family and not anybody else's, and then create havoc internally. So you can get all of that stuff going on. But I do like, and I got this from Dr. Nimhard, is that we still learn. We still get a lot out of this.
Yeah. No, I think that's really important, right? And also the gift, right, of and the importance of learning from history. So, which, you know, pointing to the real backlash that black co-ops have faced over time, right, when they have been successful from external forces, right? And I think that's still very real and something for us to always consider, like not only how do we build more co-ops or co-op infrastructure, but how do we protect it? And how can we be intentional about that? And then also the last thing that I kind of wanted to pick up on and what you said, which, you know, again, just has to become a part of the work and how we think about this work, is simply these systems of oppression and the way in which we get socialized are still in us, even as we decide to do cooperative work. And so they're going to come up. And so trying to really think about not only the personal transformation that all of us have to really take on in doing this work and committing to this work, but also the interpersonal and organizational kind of transformation that's necessary to really be successful in cooperation. And so that's one thing that I think that we have gotten better at naming. One thing that people are actually making time for, which is, really a part of investing in the long-term success of cooperative development. How do we change and transform ourselves internally, but also how can we really name these systems of exploitation and oppression and individualism that are inevitably going to make their way into the room because we've been socialized in this way. And so I think folks are doing a good job of really trying to incorporate that into cooperative development now.
Fantastic. And we're going to take our first break. And we've been talking about how you got into this. What is co-ops? What is solidarity economy? But when we come back, I would like to, if you could, give us some examples of the clients that you have worked with.
Mm-hmm. Great.
All right. And I'm quite interested in, I don't know, as many different ones, because, we have worker co-ops you've talked about. Mm-hmm. We've had consumer co-ops, housing, credit unions, rural electric. But then there's also marketing mm-hmm. co-ops and purchasing co-ops. So mm-hmm. any of those co-ops that you work with, because co-ops are created by and for the people that own it. So that's what it's all about. We'll be right back. Please don't touch that dial.
News Talk 1450 WOLAM, where information is power.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Vernon Oakes, and the program is Everything Co-op. We're talking to Renee Hatcher, who's an attorney, and she advocates for Black, Brown, and Indigenous people to have a better quality of life through law, and she's the director of the Community Enterprise and Solidarity Economy Law Clinic at the University of Illinois, Chicago. This program, Renee, we've been on a little over 10 years now. We've been on the air every Thursday.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And the National Co-op Bank has been our sponsor, financial sponsor, and main cheerleader to really help us throughout these 10 years. NCB's mission is to support and be an advocate for America's cooperatives and their members, especially in low-income communities, by providing innovative financial and related services. Renee, have you had the opportunity to work with them on any of your projects?
I haven't had an opportunity to work with them directly, but that's not to say that some of my clients haven't worked directly with them in terms of receiving support or receiving some capital and starting their cooperative.
I have found them to be a good partner for mm-hmm. co-ops anywhere in the U.S.
So Vernon, also, I wanted to congratulate you. I don't think I've had a chance to talk to you since you were inducted to the Cooperative Hall of Fame.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was mm-hmm. nominated.
So well deserved.
I was nominated and selected. The induction ceremony happens October the 3rd of this year.
Okay.
So you still have time to get a ticket and come on up and celebrate with me and four others. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because Helena Wilson, who started the Women's Auxiliary in Chicago and ran it for 10, 20 years, last year was the unsung hero. Dr. Nimhard and another lady, last name is Lung, started this Unhero series, and she was the mm-hmm. second one inducted. Mm-hmm. And I saw she's from the Ladies Auxiliary in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of women around looking after, and they did a lot of good work. And Ella Jo Baker was the first unsung hero, and mm-hmm. I was just amazed at everything that she'd done. It was also wondering, why didn't this keep going? What happened?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Keep going. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us some of the projects you've been working on.
Yeah. You know, so before we talked about individual co-ops, I think it's worth talking about some of the success that we've had recently here in Chicago overall as an ecosystem. So one of the things I wanted to mention.
Well, before you mention that, what's an ecosystem? Okay. You use that term.
Okay. Yeah. So I would say typically where we see co-ops, we see some type of surrounding ecosystem. And the ecosystem is really, it can be the champions, it can be the advocates, but typically there's some type of, you know, organizational network in places where we see a lot of thriving cooperatives. And what that means, it could be folks who are really thinking about cooperative education and doing the education piece of cooperative development. Or it can be, for example, you know, the folks who are providing support or technical assistance to cooperatives, like cooperative lawyers or cooperative accountants or cooperative bookkeepers. You know, all of sometimes the technical knowledge and expertise and infrastructure that's needed. And ideally, like, those are skills and that expertise gets transferred to folks directly within those cooperatives. But what we do find is like there's usually a chorus, right, of players and organizations that are contributing to the overall success of cooperative development, you know, in a particular, and it could be in a particular place, but also, you know, there, I think you just mentioned Ella Jo Baker. I mean, the National Cooperative Youth Negro League was kind of serving a huge infrastructure need, right? In both proliferating cooperatives around the country. I mean, Ella Baker used to travel around the country and really not just start chapters, but to talk about, you know, the importance and the impact of cooperative development, right? And at that time, it was more around consumer cooperatives. There was a lot of consumer cooperatives in the Black community around that time. But, you know, that infrastructure became really important. And sometimes it's about, you know, access to capital as well. You just mentioned the National Cooperative Bank, like that they become really important and instrumental in actually allowing more cooperatives to flourish. And so here in Chicago, you know, I would say strategically, folks in the cooperative development space have been trying to take an ecosystem approach, right, to cooperative development and thinking about, like, what are really the needs, the gaps, the organizational infrastructure that co-ops need to be successful. And some of that can be, you know, certain expertise. Some of that can be addressing policy obstacles or the ways in which traditional things happen, like financing or like loans to small businesses that don't necessarily fully understand the cooperative model. So the ecosystem becomes kind of any and everything that is contributing to cooperative development, including the co-ops themselves. And so here in Chicago, you know, this is something that folks have been working on for a very long time, and I always like to say that first and foremost. But we have been having some success around developing the ecosystem. So, you know, stretching back to 2017, in this recent iteration, folks came together to really try to identify what the obstacles were for worker co-ops in particular, but also in thinking about cooperative development more broadly. And so through that, there's been a number of coalitions. There's been a lot of organizing work. One of those early coalitions was trying to pass a state law, which we got passed in 2019 and went into effect in 2020. That created a new worker co-op legal entity for worker co-ops to use that allows them more benefits, that recognizes worker co-ops in the state of Illinois, which it didn't before. And so that was one of our early successes. But then more recently, in 2021, the city of Chicago, through a lot of advocacy, external advocacy over time, initiated a community wealth building initiative, which in part is aimed at really supporting and growing cooperative development here in the city of Chicago. And so community wealth building, as it's defined by Chicago, is really trying to support worker cooperatives and housing cooperatives and community land trusts and this new sort of tool called community investment vehicles that allows regular residents to invest and also to, you know, profit share in the development and success of commercial corridors here in the city. And so the city of Chicago invested $15 million in 2021, or pledged $15 million, which some of which, a portion of that went to technical assistance within the city so co-ops could thrive and get the services that they need. A good chunk of that went directly to cooperatives themselves for pre-development grants. So these were grants for co-ops that have already been working to get started, but might need a feasibility study or might need architect services if they have a building or a land project. So they were able to use these funds to support their development, their pre-development before they're operating. And so part of this has helped kind of provide some coherence, I would say, to the cooperative ecosystem here in Chicago. And the things that have come out of it are really not just these funds that went for technical assistance and went to directly to the cooperatives, but also working groups. So we have a new worker co-op working group. There's housing cooperative working groups. There's a community land trust working group where the projects themselves are coming together to discuss their common challenges, to talk about obstacles, to learn from each other. It's a peer learning circle. And, you know, it's provided kind of an injection of both resources, but also, I think, interest in trying to activate more and more people around cooperative development. And so that's a lot of what folks have been working on for the last few years, in addition to obviously developing different cooperative projects and operating cooperatives. And so we're really excited and proud about that win. And then also just part of it is thinking about, like, how can we continue to get support from cities like Chicago, but also cities around the country in supporting this work, because we know that it has additional benefits beyond the members of those cooperatives. So one thing that is a part of the program, I, along with my colleague Stacy Sutton at UIC Urban Planning Department, are co-directing an initiative to do the research around the success of, you know, the community wealth building initiative for the city. And so we're hoping that part of this research will not only get at the success and the impact that these cooperatives has, but the non-traditional metrics of what we know, like, cooperatives actually produce. So it's not just that they're, you know, a new business that might be paying taxes to the city, but we know that cooperatives tend to engage more in their community, that they tend to go beyond whatever the business is. And so we're trying to also capture, like, the qualitative data around what this really can mean, this different approach and this type of support to cooperatives can really mean beyond traditional small business support. So I wanted to mention that.
So what I got was, in Chicago, you've changed the laws for mainly worker co-ops that they can form in Chicago. You have laws for that. And the city of Chicago came with $15 million to help this whole ecosystem. And this ecosystem consists of both legal, that's where your clinic comes in also, but funding, and that's where this $15 million comes in, and then try to get other organizations to provide funding for these businesses. Mm-hmm. Ongoing and continuous education. But also other kinds of things like accounting and bookkeeping, just in a part of the ecosystem. And then on top of that part of the ecosystem, you have worker co-ops. Any business could be one. Consumer co-ops, that's housing and credit unions. It also is just if the consumer, the person that uses the product or services, own it. So it could be also any business that the consumer can own. And then you have purchasing co-ops and marketing co-ops. And they, through the sixth principle of cooperation among co-ops in a city like Chicago, those four different types and the number of co-ops that are there can work together with these other organizations, institutions, to create more co-ops and make co-ops more successful and people to understand them. Now, I add one more thing. I add promotions. Okay. We need to promote the cooperative model so that in every household, people know what they are.
Okay. Yeah. And that's absolutely a part of this project. So one of the things that I would encourage folks to check out We created a platform, a website, to really try to, for a number of reasons. One, we wanted to make sure that there was some kind of public directory for cooperatives that exist in Chicago. So, for example, if you're a cooperative and you need a new vendor that can provide, let's say, translation services, right? You can go onto this website and then you can find, hopefully, a cooperative that's providing that service. But the other things is that we wanted somewhere where there could be, you know, the kinds of resources to educate folks around cooperatives and around the different aspects of co-ops. And so part of this website, it also houses a resource library. And then finally, part of it also allows for co-ops themselves to go on and actually find a list of technical assistance providers that understand co-ops, that are working with co-ops, and they can get in touch with those folks directly on the website. So just in case folks are interested, it also talks all about the initiative and about the work that we've been doing here in Chicago. The website is ccwbe.org, and that'll give you some background information about what this initiative and how we structured it here in the city of Chicago is, and then hopefully can connect folks also with some of our co-ops who are operating here in the city. And so those are, you know, well, I wanted to lift that up in part to try to bring as many folks and try to really get it on their radar. Both the cooperatives that exist, but also, you know, materials that they can access around cooperative education.
Well, I've just gone to the webpage, and mm-hmm. what's on the webpage is a lot of what you've already told us. But I see a lot of women. This is Women History Month. Do you find, mm-hmm. at one point I heard that for new worker co-ops, there are majority women and majority black women that are starting co-ops, worker co-ops throughout the U.S. Have you found many women getting involved in co-ops?
Absolutely. I would say certainly for a lot of the co-ops that I work with, that the majority of owners might be women, but also there might be certainly women-led is part of what I'm finding. And then generally speaking, I would say that a lot of the co-ops that I work with are primarily people of color, women of color. And so, you know, again, I think there's like a number of layers to this to a certain extent. Black women in particular are the fastest growing entrepreneurs or segment of the entrepreneurial growth over the last few years. And so that's a broader trend that we're seeing in just business development, but certainly within cooperative development, I find that often the bulk of worker owners or members with new co-ops are tend to be women.
Okay, so you want to drill down to give some examples of co-ops that you've worked with?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, and kind of following this theme, it might make sense to highlight some of my clients who certainly like fit this mold. One of the clients that I've worked with for a while since they started, in which, you know, and one of the things I should say, Vernon, is that I only talk about clients in which we've gotten explicit permission and also, you know, have had different public communication about our work with them, in part because of professional responsibility of lawyers and client confidentiality. But one of the clients that we work with that have been public and have given us explicit permission to talk about our work with them is Blue Tin Production Cooperative. And one of the reasons why I named them in particular is in part because they're a women-owned worker co-op that does textile production, primarily made up of worker owners who are immigrant women, and really trying to think about both the conditions and also their previous experience in the mainstream economy around like work exploitation, but also thinking more broadly about the larger harm done in the fashion industry in terms of fashion production, specifically to women, third world women, in working conditions and worker exploitation. And so one of the reasons why I really love how they've been thinking about both the way in which they talk about their work and their business itself is because they're trying to bring attention to the exploitation of workers and women workers in particular around the fashion industry, and really trying to think about ways in which to demonstrate that a different model is possible and the need for ethical fashion. And part of that is like the education of consumers around fashion and what we're actually purchasing and what we're incentivizing, right? Because unfortunately, it's an industry certainly where things are getting worse. When we think about new types of mass production or new types of platforms like Temu, where you can buy clothes for almost pennies on the dollar, right? There are people on the other side of that producing, having to produce at both rates that are unsustainable, but that actually require exploitation, that require, you know, hours of work that are often inhumane. And so, you know, I think that they're a good example of the type of co-ops that we try to support and also prioritize in providing pro bono or free legal service.
Wow. So I did go to CCWBE.
Mm-hmm. .org.
.org. And Chicago Community Wealth Building, CCWBE, ecosystem. Chicago Community Wealth Building, ecosystem.org. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I clicked on directory, and I had all kinds of businesses up in here. A couple of them are fine. Well, I know about Shy Fresh. Mm-hmm. And because they're on your webpage, I assume you can talk about them. Are on that webpage.
So I do want to make a distinction, though. So Shy Fresh is also another client of the clinic that has been public about our work with them and that we can talk about in terms of our work. But CCWBE is separate and apart from my legal clinic in which I do work. But Shy Fresh is another great example. Shy Fresh is a food prep and catering company here in Chicago that is owned primarily by Black women or worker owners who have all have experiences with the criminal justice system. And so.
Well, I'm sorry. They had experiences with the criminal injustice system, you said?
Exactly. Right. Yes. Part of the impetus, right, for Shy Fresh is also giving agency and really ownership and say, right, for folks who have unfortunately had these experiences with the criminal injustice system to control their work situations. I mean, we know what that looks like here in the state of Illinois is actually somewhat, you know, relative to other states, somewhat better in terms of work opportunities for returning citizens, only because we have passed the law around Ban the Box. And so when you apply to get a job, yeah, that employer is not supposed to ask about your criminal history. And we know that, you know, that's not necessarily always true, that still happens. But a lot of states don't even necessarily have that protection in place. And it becomes extremely difficult, right, for folks who are returning citizens to have access to meaningful job opportunities, like once they come back. And that really is just the beginning of it. Obviously, it goes way beyond that in terms of stable and affordable quality housing and having access to that. And all of the things that you need just to simply like put the pieces of your life back together when you do return to your community. And so Shy Fresh is doing a lot of wonderful work in terms of not only the thinking about how do we address that, but then also thinking even how do we provide access to fresh food, you know, to really, I get the sense that a lot of their clientele is community institutions. It's schools. It's community centers. It's other types of community projects that they're providing meals to as well.
So, what's another one? Then I won't pick them from that webpage.
Yeah, but I do want to encourage folks to go there just to see, you know, the community of co-ops that exist and also are emerging here in Chicago.
So one of them, as an example, I didn't know was there's a yoga co-op where the teachers would be employees would own it. So that I found that one interesting. Ice cream co-op. I find that I can't eat it anymore, but I like
Justice Cream. Justice Cream is another of our public clients at my clinic, and they do really wonderful stuff. So they are actually organized as a nonprofit, but they're a nonprofit co-op, sometimes with folks referred to as a self-directed or worker self-directed nonprofit. So what that means is that they have really good ice cream, and you can probably eat it because it's vegan. Mm. And so it's non-dairy ice cream. And I promise you, I tend not to like vegan ice cream. That's not necessarily my thing, but it's really good. Their flavors are really good. And so you have to try it. Next time you're in Chicago, you let me know and we'll get some Justice ice cream. But even more than that, it's not just that it's good ice cream. What they do is they partner with grassroots organizations here in Chicago to develop a specific flavor. And then as they start to sell that flavor, 100% of the profits of the sales of a particular flavor go to that grassroots organization and to fund their work. And so, you know, we can talk about some of the flavors, which I think are really clever. So they have Snacktivists, which, you know, goes to, I can't remember exactly the nonprofit organization, but they have a flavor called Aboleche Ice, which goes to support OCAD, which does a lot of really great organizing here in Chicago around abolishing ICE, but also just like trying to push for changes in the immigration system here. And so they have a number of different flavors that they do in partnership with community organizations. One, for example, is in partnership with the Chicago Torture Justice Center. And so they're funding a grassroots organizing. And then separate from the ice cream, they're also doing a lot of public education around the solidarity economy. So they're actively trying to activate more people here in Chicago around solidarity economy, around cooperative development. And they do a lot of publication or public education work around that.
So I see why they're called Justice Ice Cream. Okay.
Yes.
Vegan ice cream. All right. Yeah, I'll take you up on that one. That sounds like a great idea. What message or messages would you like to leave people with?
I think there's so many things for us to talk about as we think about what's happening in the world at this moment and the genocide in Gaza. As we think about, you know, what's happening with the climate crisis and the way in which frontline communities that are mostly Black and Brown communities are being displaced, forced immigration around the crisis, you know, we can trace the line to all of those things in terms of our economic system, our global economic system. And so part of this work on a very practical level, obviously, is changing the conditions of folks, and whether that be in housing and having, you know, stability in housing so folks can then have resources to do other things in their life or to live a quality life, or whether that's worker co-ops. I think that everyone needs to start thinking about how they get involved in this work, and also the larger changes that we need to really start to make meaningful transformational change. And to me, cooperatives are a one key way for us to do that today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Renee Hatcher. Thank you, Attorney Renee Hatcher. I really appreciate you taking your time out to be with us today. And for everybody out there, this is Women's History Month, and we have several really great people coming up the rest of this month. We'll see you next Thursday. Please live cooperatively.
The preceding program was paid for by Everything Co-op.